You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last night, the Democratic National Convention got underway. Speeches from First Lady Michelle Obama, San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, and Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Joining me now for a look at last night's speeches and what's been going on around the convention center is Baratunde Thurston, who's serving as a WNYC special correspondent. He is the author of How to Be Black. He's a former digital director of The Onion and founder of Baratunde.com. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. How you doing?
It's good to be back. I love that you refer to me as founder of my own domain name. That was very good. I guess technically the founder of Baratunde.com.
Well, there are.
The company is Cultivated Wit, which is the thing I'm more substantively founded rather than just registering my name on the internet. But it is good to be back, Leonard, and thank you for having me.
I'll never refer to you in that way again. What are some of the differences from last week that you've seen in Charlotte so far?
Well, there are so many. I would say the diversity is much higher in some ways, much lower in others. There are far fewer khakis at this convention than there were at the Republican gathering in Tampa last week. There are far more people of color, young people, women. It's a veritable sea of all of America. And the energy level is what stands out most to me. I don't know if there are more people or if they're just more fired up, but the energy at the RNC, it wasn't down. It wasn't like people were depressed. They were directed more toward ending Obama than sort of creating a President Romney. And in this case, on the DNC side, it's much more Obama, four more years kind of vibe. They're shirt salesmen on the street aggressively peddling their wares. They're button salesmen and women. There are drummers, and it has the feel of a music festival with maybe less beer but more flags.
Well, I've heard one of the differences is also that people were reluctant to go out in Tampa because of the weather, and so that kept some people out of the convention center. It also kept the protesters down to a minimum. There are a lot more protesters in Charlotte than there were in Tampa. Have you seen many of them?
I have not seen any of them, and I think one of the strange phenomena of actually going to a convention is that you see less of it in many ways. So I have a deeper view of a narrower set of activities. Certainly the situation, the physical situation of the gathering, we're in the heart of downtown. Tampa didn't quite feel that way. There were no other people around. People definitely left town in part due to the hurricane. A lot of the cab drivers I spoke to down in Tampa said people left even before that. They wanted to kind of get out of the way of the convention. And it seems like in Charlotte, people actually wanted to get in the way and kind of put themselves in the path of this storm of delegates and media.
I read in Twitter that you put yourself in the path of some Secret Service men. You took a wrong turn in the convention center.
Wow. So, yeah, I ended up in the bowels of the arena here, the Time Warner Cable Arena. Also, interestingly, we're at the Time Warner Cable Arena. We're supposed to be at the Bank of America Stadium. It looks like that's changed due to the storm. But companies that Americans love to hate seem to be where the Democrats have doubled down on selecting in terms of the venue choices. So I ended up underground. I found a bunch of fun discoveries down there. I found the speech writing room where words are crafted. I found a bunch of cages, and there were volunteers in some cages. They had food and water, so I suppose they were mildly well taken care of, but they actually referred to them as cage 1 through 4. And then most eerily, I was trying to leave just at the end of the First Lady speech. The elevator door opened, and there was a group of heavily armed, uniformed men with what I guess could pass for smiles. And the door opened, and I decided maybe I shouldn't step out on that floor. The door closes dramatically, and then I get down to the first floor. The door opens. I step off into at least, I'd say, five suited and earplugged, dark lapelled Secret Service men asking me where did I think I was going. And I said, I'm just trying to leave, sir. Just trying to leave. He said, are you media? Yes. And he pointed to this other door off to the side, and I went through that, and there were more Secret Service on the other side of that door with their back to the door, so they spun around. And I was like, just minding my business, just trying to get out of your way. Whatever you're here to do, I am not a part of it. So.
And here you are to tell the tale, so I guess it's okay. last
it was
night,
more than okay. Yeah.
Well, last night, watching it on television, it looked like the crowd was pretty ecstatic when Michelle Obama came out to speak. She remains more popular than her husband and almost every political figure in the country. Was it apparent why last night?
It became extraordinarily apparent why. I mean, you could feel the buzz building. And this is, you know, the transformation of public perception around the First Lady is an incredible journey over the past 4 or 5 years. I was there at her talk in Denver 4 years ago, and there was a lot of excitement, but it was sort of anticipatory excitement. It was also, I think, a little bit defensive excitement because there had been, at that time 4 years ago, a heavy amount of attacks against the soon-to-be First Lady, questioning whether she was patriotic and was she one of us? Was she really American? And those doubts, to the extent that they ever existed among this crowd, were resoundingly defeated before her talk. Even as I don't know if this played on television, but there was an introductory video of her first mom, first lady, and after that video, everyone expected that Michelle Obama would emerge triumphant. And then they had one speaker before her, who was a military mom. She had 4 or 5 sons in each of the services, and there was a moment of people catching their breath because they expected the First Lady, and they got not the First Lady, and it was like, no, introducing not Michelle Obama, and there was like a palpable catch in people's throat, a little groan from a few sections, and then people heard what, you know, this mother had to say, and it was consistent with the thing, but almost like with Romney last week, when they had a beautiful video of him, and then it went to Clint Eastwood, and then it went to Marco Rubio. This was a much shorter interlude, but there was still this, you could feel it. People wanted to explode out of their chairs, and when she finally did take the stage, the signs went up in the air, the hands were clapping, people were on their feet, and she had to settle them down a couple of times. They wanted to share that love. It was a powerful moment.
In her speech, she talked about how broke she and her husband were when they were young. Let's listen to a clip.
When Barack was a senator and a presidential candidate, to me, he was still the guy who picked me up for our dates in a car that was so rusted out. I could actually see the pavement going by in a hole in the passenger side door. He was the guy whose proudest possession was a coffee table he'd found in a dumpster. And whose only pair of decent shoes was a half size too small.
Well, last week, Ann Romney talked about the garden apartment that she and her husband lived in as newlyweds and the cans of tuna they ate. Are the spouses kind of trying to one-up each other on how little money they once had and how devoted they were to raising their children?
There's maybe a little bit of a mom off, a little bit of a wife off, a little bit of a hard times off. I think the difference, one, we know the stories of both candidates to a degree. We know the sketches of them. We know the extreme versions. Romney's the money guy. Obama's the president guy who's, you know, didn't have any business experience, was a community organizer, all these things. So what Michelle Obama did in a way that I think exceeded Ann Romney, and obviously I'm a bit biased because I did think Ann Romney did a great talk and her audience, you know, ate it up. But the connection between the personal story and the policies was woven much more seamlessly through the First Lady's speech than it was through Ann Romney's speech. And so both of them had these very compelling personal stories that had triumph, that had pain, that had babies, and some sort of challenge. With Ann Romney's talk, the translation of that personal story into the politics of her husband/candidate was much more abrupt. It came more toward the end. It felt a little more forced. And I think with the First Lady, she did this weave in and out throughout. And it was just a much smoother connection. You actually felt, oh, yeah, she's reminding us of who she is and who he is. And that's where the politics come from. And that's where his governing style comes from. And why these things are important or not to these folks is much sharper.
I'm talking to Baratunde Thurston, who's serving as a WNYC special correspondent to both the Republican and Democratic conventions. We're speaking to him from the convention floor. The First Lady cast the fight for health care in almost moral terms as being the right thing to do. Here's another clip from her speech.
When it comes to the health of our families, Barack refused to listen to all those folks who told him to leave health reform for another day, another president. He didn't care whether it was the easy thing to do politically. No, that's not how he was raised. He cared that it was the right thing to do.
Is that the way the Democrats are going to have to talk about health care, as something of a moral imperative?
Well, I think it's the way Democrats have generally talked about it. I think it's also fun to see the transition of the story of health care from one that was the imperative in the early days of the administration to something that no one really wanted to talk about. This challenge, is it Obamacare? Is it this or that? And now you have to embrace it. You know, when you look back at what the administration has accomplished, this is a big one. And so they've gone full throat in embracing, we did that. You know, we built that, to borrow a phrase from the RNC last week, and not to dance around what healthcare was and was it worth it. It's a done deal from a legislative perspective, not an implementation one, obviously. But the full-throated embrace of healthcare is a major part of the platform and a part of the buzz around these holes.
Deval Patrick, who succeeded Romney as governor of Massachusetts, took the stage earlier in the night and got a great response from the crowd. We'll be breaking down that speech in a bit with Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post, but I want to get your reaction to this clip.
Quit waiting for pundits or polls or super PACs to tell us who the next president or senator or congressman is going to be. We're Americans. We shape our own future.
Isn't that similar to what we heard from Republicans last week, that you can shape your own destiny?
There is going to be some overlap. I mean, both parties talk about the value of hard work and rewarding people who play by the rules. The ability to shape your own destiny, that's part of the whole American dream / mythology. You can do anything you want as long as you, you know, grab those bootstraps of yours and yank really hard. So I think, you know, what Deval Patrick spoke about is a universal theme. He also just went on the attack against his predecessor, Mitt Romney, saying he was more interested in having the job of governor of Massachusetts than doing the job, and sort of implying that might be the case with his presidency. The difference between the RNC theme and the DNC theme is that the RNC one is much more individualistic. There's an attack that government is sort of in the way of that individual progress and those individual prospects. And on the DNC side, it's like, oh, we can do this together. I think the other major difference that I've noticed, and especially in the talks, all these speakers were excited to mention the name of their nominee. And that was such a difference from last week, where you felt like when they said Mitt Romney, it had been inserted into a speech about themselves. It had been inserted into a speech about conservative values. And I believe in low taxes and Mitt Romney. And when it came to President Obama, you know, the level of four more years and spontaneous chants breaking out unprovoked was a very different tonal difference of the Democrats versus the Republicans.
But I think
they're proud to embrace that nominee.
Patrick also was kind of hinting that the fundraising edge that the Romney campaign can be made up if Democrats start helping a bit more. Julian Castro, the mayor of San Antonio, was the keynote speaker. And we have a little clip from his speech.
Now, in Texas, we believe in the rugged individual. Texas may be the one place where people actually still have bootstraps. And we expect folks to pull themselves up by him. But we also recognize that there are some things we can't do alone. We have to come together and invest in opportunity today for prosperity tomorrow.
You'd mentioned bootstraps earlier. Can we ever talk enough about bootstraps during a presidential campaign?
No, I mean, maybe you should have bootstraps for president. Maybe they should hand out bootstraps in the swag bags when you register for your credentials. That's what Julian Castro just said was a major dividing line, and it's a little bit of an ironic twist, because the Republicans use this "we built it" phrase as an attack against President Obama, but the "we" is what the Democratic Party is focusing on, and they're not trying to deny the individual success and talent and fortune and luck that goes into success, but their emphasis is on the "we" part and saying, there are things that we can't do alone, that we can't do alone. We need infrastructure and we need investment. That's the other major dividing line you have, is the party who says, stop spending, stop this growth in government, stop, stop, stop. And then the other party, the Democratic Party, saying, yeah, but let's invest at the same time. And so they're trying to make it a choice between austerity and cutting versus investing in education and infrastructure and other things that have returns maybe more down the line. What I really wanted from Castro was, you know, he had all this Texas love going. Texas is like its own nation at these gatherings. They really love their state. They wear their flags proudly, maybe sometimes too loudly. If he had closed that on the Friday Night Lights, Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, Can't Lose, the audience would have completely lost it. And I might have even pledged allegiance to the flag of the Republic of Texas.
The Texas Republicans had coordinated their outfits. There were a bunch of cowboy hats in the Texas delegation last night as well. I'm glad you brought up the swag bags, because last week we talked about some of the swag you'd seen in and around the convention center in Tampa, like Mitt Romney lotion at the, or is it Mint Romney lotion at the
Mint Romney, yes.
Huffington,
yes.
Oasis Lounge. Have you seen any interesting ones this week? Other than T-shirts,
yeah, so
with the president's face on them?
The media bags that we've gotten as part of the press pool core thing is much more interesting. I mean, last week that bag consisted of Mitt Romney's book, which is, you know, I guess interesting, but we're in a digital age, so handing out a book to everybody, to me, is mildly offensive to the which, you know, everybody's trying to be a part of. I'm thinking this one, we had iPad cases, but no iPads. So it was kind of a passive-aggressive attempt to stimulate the economy, I suppose. There was a pedometer, presumably to get you to walk more, which they've done by design with this convention, maybe as part of the First Move initiative, a subtle order to get us walking and burning those calories a bit more. And there was a water bottle, a collapsible, foldable kind of water bag slash bottle. Do love drinking out of a bag. It's one of my greatest goals in life, is to drink out of a bag. So they've given us that opportunity. So I think there was more of value in this, and maybe a little bit more on message goods, in an attempt to subtly sway the media with those trinkets.
Well, one of the areas that both parties have stressed is the importance of the vote, the women's vote.
Yeah.
Are you surprised by how aggressively both parties have been at courting the women's vote?
Not at all. I mean, every election, federal, sort of presidential election cycle, the women's vote becomes a significant issue, in part because of Supreme Court implications and Roe versus Wade and abortion rights.
And Lily Ledbetter spoke last night.
Lily Ledbetter, first of all, blew the roof off. I would probably do anything Lily Ledbetter told me to, because her name is Lily Ledbetter. And I just don't want to be on the wrong side of that. She sounds like a gangster from another time, and I'm mildly intimidated and also full of admiration.
She's been on the show. She's a sweet old lady.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's what she wants you to think, Leonard. But then behind that sweet exterior is a hardcore activist. No, she was wonderful. And I think for the Democrats to play off of and play into some of the challenges that their RNC side has, with the big focus on contraception that we've seen between these presidential election cycles, with the determination of just what rape and sexual assault are, with the actual representation and diversity of the parties versus who gets programmed on stage, it's a great battle to have. And the women's vote, such as it is not necessarily a full block, but it is significantly important. It's also one of the biggest gaps we have in actual representation to elected office in this country. So there's a lot of energy around not only the vote, but the candidacy of women. And the Democrats were not pulling any punches last night in trying to exploit the weaknesses of the opposition party on that score.
Baratunde Thurston is the author of How to Be Black, the former digital director of The Onion. He is serving as a special correspondent for WNYC. And thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks always for having me. It's been a pleasure.